Welcome to the FDD Events Podcast. I'm Cliff Mate, founder and president of FDD, and pleased to share with you the following conversation. Please subscribe, rate, and review the podcast so you don't miss out on future FDD events.
Good morning. It's Monday, March 4th. The war in the Middle East is now 150 days old. I'm Jonathan Shanzer, Senior Vice President for Research at Foundation for Defense of Democracies, and welcome back to the FDD Morning Brief. I'm back from an overseas trip this morning. I'd hoped that it would change my perspective on this war, but if anything, with a little distance, I'm feeling a bit more convinced about a few things, and we'll be talking about those things in the days to come. But in the meantime, it's good to be back in the saddle here at the FDD Morning Brief. I'm going to keep doing this three times a week, so thanks for tuning in. Israeli journalist and intellectual Haviv Rategor will be joining us shortly. He's a writer with the Times of Israel. He also appears regularly on the Call Me Back podcast, hosted by Dan Senor, who was a guest on the Morning Brief just a few weeks ago. We'll speak to Haviv in just a few minutes. But first, I want to talk about Jordan. We don't discuss Jordan much here on the Morning Brief. That's because the country is not waging war against Israel, and that's a good thing. But all is not well between Israel and the Hashemite Kingdom. Yesterday, Roi Case from Israel's Channel 11 reported that the Jordanians just asked Israel to extend its deliveries of water to the kingdom. Jordan has experienced drought in recent years. The request comes amidst a downturn in Jordan's economy in recent years, and this has corresponded with increased anti-Israel rhetoric. I authored a report in late 2022 about this rhetoric and how it contrasted sharply with the Abraham Accords countries. I mean, Jordan was supposed to be the warm piece in the region. Well, since October 7th, the rhetoric has only gotten worse. The Queen, who is of Palestinian origin, has downplayed the 10/7 slaughter while spewing rhetoric that clearly appeals to Jordan's majority Palestinian population. Jordan's foreign minister, Ayman al-Safadi, has been nothing short of vitriolic, and the King has dished out a bit of this too. Here's the thing. Israel should provide more water to Jordan, and gas, and intelligence cooperation, and more. These are the terms of the peace agreement that has served both countries well for almost 30 years. A stable Jordan is crucial to Israeli national security, and it's crucial to the U.S.-led world order, certainly the Middle East world order. But Jordan needs to give when it takes. The Jordanians are the custodians of the Al-Aqsa Mosque, and in the past years, Jordanian rhetoric has only made things worse during Ramadan. Well, now, Ramadan is once again approaching. So how about this? How about Israel says yes to the water, and in return, Jordan stops spewing anti-Israel rhetoric during Ramadan? That seems fair to me. Will it happen? Well, that's what diplomats are for. Now for your headlines. Headline one. Lebanon's foreign minister, Abdullah Bou Habib, says he wants indirect talks with Israel. You heard that right. Lebanon doesn't recognize Israel yet. Over the weekend, the country's top diplomat said that talks were needed because the alternative is the expansion of the war in the region. Well, Abdullah Bou, I've got news for you. There already is a war in the region. And a lot of that stems from the fact that Hezbollah has taken over your country. In fact, Lebanon is now a failed state because of Hezbollah. That said, I don't see the harm in talking at this point, because at the rate we are going, including the strikes and counterstrikes reported just this morning, Hezbollah and Israel are well on their way to an all-out conflict. Relatedly, headline two, Hezbollah Secretary General Hassan Nasrallah reportedly lost his grandson to an Israeli drone strike on Saturday. This is not new for Nasrallah. His son was killed during clashes with Israel back in 1997, and Nasrallah is not the only Hezbollah leader to lose a loved one in the war. Mohammad Raad, a leading Hezbollah parliamentarian, lost his son to an Israeli strike back in November. These two are among the more than 210 Hezbollahis killed since the group opened up a second front on October 8th. I just need to say it. Do you know what would have prevented these losses? Not fighting. Nobody forced Hezbollah to enter this war. Fine, they may have been urged on by the regime in Iran, but they have brought this upon themselves. And if they're not careful, the war will widen further. And if that happens, the devastation in Lebanon will be worse than anything we have seen in the Middle East to date. If there ever was a moment for Nasrallah to stand down, this would be it. And headline three. The clock is ticking to get a Ramadan ceasefire with 6 days left before the month-long holiday begins. Hamas appears to be the problem here. The group refuses to share the total number of hostages that are still alive. The Israelis have already said that they are game for a trade that would include dozens more Palestinian prisoners in exchange for the release of Israelis still held by Hamas. The pressure should be on Hamas here, or maybe even the Qataris, but somehow it's not. We're watching the U.S. pile the pressure on the Israelis primarily. This includes a speech yesterday by Vice President Kamala Harris, but her comments did not upset the Israelis the way that some thought it would. What U.S. officials don't seem to grasp is that Hamas, Hezbollah, and Iran all actually want things to go to hell in a handbasket during Ramadan, and the Israelis don't. They want to prevent chaos. They want their hostages back. They want to get the Gaza civilians out of harm's way before the Rafah operation. But that probably won't change the rhetoric in the United States right now, because if it plays well among certain voters, I suspect it's going to continue. Okay, it's now my pleasure to introduce Haviv Redick-Gor. Haviv is a keen observer of all things Israel. His writings appear often at the Times of Israel. His voice appears often at the podcast called Call Me Back. And now, after a brief special effect that we affectionately call the whoosh, his face will appear before us here at the FDD Morning Brief. That's the whoosh. Welcome, Haviv Redick-Gor.
Hi, Jonathan. Thank you for having me.
Great to have you. Well, first, let's talk about where we are in this war. The pressure is clearly getting heaped on Israel right now between accusations of excessive force, efforts to enforce a ceasefire before Ramadan, tensions flaring in the north. All of this seems pretty chaotic, but I suspect there's some order to this chaos, isn't there?
Yeah, I think that the order is pretty easy to suss out from the endless stream of news and information that constantly comes out of a battlefield in this age of TikTok and Twitter and such. The bottom line on the ground in Gaza is that the IDF operation, the war itself, in military terms, leaving aside the politics and the diplomacy and the humanitarian crisis, which is real and important, just militarily, the IDF has won. It's won completely. It's won spectacularly. It has won the war for the ground, with the exception of Rafah. There is now the long war, the war that we always knew would be what the defense minister 4 months ago called the third stage, which is the tunnel war, the counterinsurgency war. That's the war for pulling the Hamas cells that remain in the areas where the battalions and the brigades have been shattered out of the civilian population, out of the tunnels, destroying the tunnels. We don't know if we've destroyed 25% of the tunnels at this point or 45%. Estimates differ. But the IDF controls the ground to the extent that it wanted to at this stage, and even more so. It's been a better war than the IDF expected and that Hamas expected. And I think that the most important thing to know about this moment in the war is that because the IDF has proven, just in the very simple fact that nobody expected it to be 200-something IDF dead at this point, the Americans predicted at the beginning of the ground operation that we'd be looking at something three times that, five times that. It went well. But now that the IDF is in control of most of the ground, now that the counterinsurgency, most of the reservists have been let go, there's a smaller force now, and it is engaged in a constant, persistent counterinsurgency that we expect to take months, if not, in single-digit number of years. Which is how these things go. I think it took the American-led coalition 5 years to get ISIS actually out of northern Iraq. But now that means that we have shifted from the military section of that war, that part of the war, we have shifted to a much more political part of the war, where we start needing solutions to things like the humanitarian aid distribution that Hamas can upset. There isn't really anyone in control on the ground to deliver the aid. All of these problems were the day after problems, essentially, right? The army thought, the Israeli, I think, political leadership thought that you win the war over 2 years, and then you think about the day after. Turns out that because of the aid crisis, the day after is already here upon us, and that's a political question. So we've shifted. How well is the war gone? It's gone well enough for the day after to arrive 5 months into what people were thinking of as a 1.5-year war, essentially.
Let's talk about that day after in a minute. But first, I want to ask you about the politics of Israel. And I don't want to get into whether Bibi is right or Bibi is wrong, or whether Bibi needs to leave the government, or whether he's going to be forced out, or what's going on with Benny Gantz, who's here in Washington, or anyone else for that matter in the Israeli political scene. But I think my big question is, what about Israeli unity? I mean, we saw that the entire country came together after 10-7. Is the country backsliding back to a 10-6 mentality, as some suggest?
I'm going to say something that counts for most of the political system to avoid partisanship or just direct sort of politicking, which I really do feel a need to avoid also just because of internal Israeli discourse. There are still soldiers fighting a war. This is not a moment for that. But our political class is a political class that was forged by a certain kind of politics. This is happening in many places around the world. The science of marketing, the capacity to hack the human brainstem and manipulate populations, has really, to a terrifying and frustrating extent, taken over a lot of political campaign skill sets and a lot of political campaign firms all over the Western world. And that's true here. And so we have a politics of polarization here, which is remarkable because we don't actually have much disagreement between different Israeli populations on fundamental policy. In America, you know, Republicans and Democrats increasingly don't like each other, but they also disagree on fundamental questions. In Israel, most people mostly agree on most things, and we still manage to have the same politics of polarization. And I think it goes back to these strategies and really scientific psychological manipulation skills that have taken over politics. I say all that just to say the campaigns are back. On the Likud side, we've seen Twitter accounts activated in the last month that were campaign Twitter accounts. That's true on the other side as well. We know that a lot of the rhetoric in Israel about Palestinian state not being possible and Netanyahu standing firm against it is domestic politics rather than policy. There isn't really been a policy discussion on these things. It's a lot of posturing. And so I think that the political campaigns are back. With the political campaigns, we've started to see some protests, still minor protests, still 100,000 people isn't minor, but it's much less than what it could be. And it's also around hostages. It's also around questions related to the war is still the vocabulary of public debate, even when we are talking about our polarization and really that kind of thing. Once there's a sense among the Israeli public, I think, that the war has receded, that the soldiers are no longer in danger, that a left-wing voting soldier and a right-wing voting soldier fighting side by side, that we're not betraying them by going back to the fight, I do think the campaigns are back in full swing and we're going to see major protests and Israeli politics will be back. And incidentally, I'm not sure that's a terrible thing. In other words, I don't want this unity ordinarily. I'm not sure that's healthy.
I actually tend to agree with that. It's a very thoughtful insight right there. I think seeing some disagreement in Israel, I mean, you always talk about how you put two Israelis in a room and you get 10 opinions, and that's always been what Israel has been about. So I think there is something very healthy about that. But let me ask you about one other thing that I've been watching and I find fascinating. All this talk about Haredim, the ultra-Orthodox, and their service or lack thereof in the IDF. Is this the right time to push for this? And what would be the implications here if this moves forward?
The IDF has been, for at least 30 years now, starting to rethink how you fight wars. And it's been talking about itself as a more efficient and smaller and also more powerful, but powerful in all kinds of, with all kinds of force multipliers that aren't personnel, a more efficient and smaller military. October 7 ended that. It ended decades of that kind of thought. And it ended it very abruptly. And going forward, the IDF is now going to invest massively in the most humdrum, boring kind of infantry battalions of the, you know, of ordinary grunts on all the borders. No offense to, I was an extremely ordinary grunt in the army, but it's going to need many, many more tens of thousands of those, and it's going to need them permanently. And so the army now, in terms of personnel, is starting to grow, and we're already seeing it in the in the November already, really. There's a November draft and there's a March draft. There are three or four drafts in a year, depending on units. And in this March draft, we're seeing an army that's starting to talk about needing 7,000 more soldiers every year, that's starting to talk about needing more than 2,000 more that's the Hebrew, positions, posts for officers in the army every year. It's an army that's looking to grow and to grow quickly. The ultra-Orthodox community used to be 3% of Israel when the country was founded. They have a draft exemption. They have a pretty significant welfare state that they live within. The average Haredi household takes much more from the welfare state than it pays in taxes. The average non-Haredi household does the opposite. And that was a kind of culture that was... There's a deep and profound and serious and beautiful reason for the culture that they have built. And that is that they believe themselves to be, and to some extent really were, representative of what was destroyed in the Holocaust. In other words, 85%, something like that, of the Jews killed in the Holocaust were Yiddish speakers and not Western Jews, and Jews who spoke German or French or English. And so there was a desperate sense among them that in Israel, they have to rebuild what was lost. Great. That's wonderful. That's beautiful. That has been done. It has been done tenfold in terms of that religious community. And now they're 13% of the population. So when they were 3%, we could afford that welfare state and we could afford that draft exemption. It was one tiny minority with a religious exemption and a unique lifestyle, and nobody cared. But they're now so big and so powerful and so much a part of Israeli daily life that they need to start shouldering the burden. And it used to be, until really October 7, this was a question of principles, of equality, of secular families wondering why their kids were in danger while the ultra-Orthodox families' kids were not. It's no longer a principle question. The army needs 7,000 more soldiers a year. There's not a lot of places it can find them. And so it's now become a very pragmatic question. So that's why it's come up. It's okay that it's come up. This is an issue that's been kicked, you know, we've been kicking that can down the road for years and years, generations, really, and we can't anymore. And that's now going to be something that we discuss until we find a solution, because we need battalions on the borders.
I think it's also interesting, by the way, I mean, they're much more politically active now. And if that's the case, then it makes sense that they'd also take a part in the military components of this as well as the politics. I think it certainly starts
I have to say, in their defense, truly, polling them on the question of should ultra-Orthodox serve, or 20 years ago when you said, if an ultra-Orthodox person did serve, what do you feel about them? The answer was disdain and even betrayal. Today, overwhelmingly, the answer is pride. And there's more and more responses to polls that say that it is okay. They want their elite students, seminary students, yeshiva students, to stay in yeshiva. That's fine. You know, extraordinary artists, extraordinary athletes among secular Israelis also get draft exemptions. But there is a willingness among them also that we haven't seen before. So it is coming from both ends.
Okay, last question for you here. I want to just circle back to that aid incident that we saw, the shooting incident in Gaza. You know, you were talking before about how we've reached the day after. We've also now seen, I think we can fairly say that there are competing narratives about what just happened in Gaza. I think you've been a straight shooter when Israel has been in the wrong. And you've been a fierce defender of Israel when it is right. What do you think happened here? Does Israel have something to atone for? Are there things that Israel can or should do better when it comes to this assistance now that we've reached that day after scenario that you discussed?
On the specific question of that specific incident, it is extremely probable. We don't really know. I don't really know yet. Which decision by whom caused which death. The army says 10 people were killed by a steady escalation of gunfire by soldiers who saw a mob sort of stampeding toward them. The mob was desperate people trying to get food. The aid convoy drivers and gunmen protecting the aid convoy, I'm not yet clear on who exactly the gunmen were, apparently did most of the killing, and the human crush did most of the killing. The media coverage was terrible at first, as it always is in Gaza. I mean, the first Hamas report was that there was an airstrike. That's clearly a mistake, but that was the headline of the AP story that came out of that crush at the very beginning. So everything I've just said is essentially the Israeli, official Israeli version. I hope it's right. To me, the specific details are secondary, because even if the truth is somewhere between the Israelis are responsible for most of the specific deaths in this specific incident to what Israel says, which is for almost none. I mean, for a very small number, the idea is actually the larger question isn't this incident. The larger question is the next 150 incidents that are coming, because the aid issue can't be ignored anymore. And that's the point, that the army, I think, and the political leadership as well, have had this mindset, have had this way of thinking about this war, because it's how counterinsurgencies have worked in the past in other places. During the counterinsurgency, you don't rush in. That's not the moment where you need this massive aid program. We thought we could finish one and then start the other. The collapse of Hamas, and not just the quick collapse of Hamas, but the way Hamas has devoted itself since it began to understand its collapse, because the battalions couldn't actually fight, it turns out. They tried to mount company-scale, battalion-scale attacks on Israeli soldiers and failed throughout the last 5 months. They essentially devolved power to cells, to tiny little groups of 4 guys, 10 guys, and their job is just to disrupt, and they don't even need command and control anymore. And so they've been also disrupting the aid convoys. They've been either protecting aid convoys that they start out protecting them, but then they steal them. They have been threatening UNRWA truck drivers. They have been trying to disrupt, trying to increase the chaos and suffering in Gaza, because they no longer see themselves ruling Gaza. They now see themselves as preventing anyone else from ruling Gaza. We need a day after. We need someone who can take control. If it can't be the Israelis for various reasons, it needs to be someone else, and we need it now. So what I see that incident as telling us is the Israelis need a plan. And in that sense, that is the deep criticism right now I have of the government at the moment. And it's a criticism that's very short-lived. We could also put in place a plan, find those partners, get that infrastructure going, but it needs to start happening right now. That, I think, is the message from that incident.
Sounds like we've officially reached the insurgency. Okay, thank you, Habib Retegor, for taking time out to join us today on the FTD Morning Brief.
Thanks for having me, Jim.
Okay, here's what FTD has on tap for you today. My colleagues Jacob Nagel and Mark Dubowitz are out with a new essay in the Jerusalem Post, arguing that even while serious proxy threats challenge Israel across multiple borders, the Israelis have really no choice but to stay focused on countering the most severe threat to its existence, Iran's nuclear weapons program. It's not easy to stay focused these days, but these guys are absolutely correct. The nuclear program is the big one. FTD's David May has a new piece out on Friday in the National Interest, looking at a shadowy figure in South Africa who directs multiple organizations that appear to be providing support to Hamas. The guy's name is Ibrahim Gabriels. I've never heard of him before, but my sense is that we'll be hearing more about him in the weeks or even months to come. And finally, FTD adjunct fellow Haysam Hassanein appeared on NPR this weekend to talk about an Egyptian company that is facilitating border crossings for select Gazans who are able to pay thousands of dollars in fees to get across the border. He suggests that this company would not be able to operate without the full cooperation of the Egyptian security apparatus. Haysam, by the way, is an Egyptian national, and he thinks this might be part of an effort by Cairo to inject some cash into the struggling Egyptian economy. Oh, and by the way, I continue to hear about those tunnels that almost certainly lie beneath the Philadelphia corridor along the Gaza-Egypt border. Did the Egyptian government also keep those operational in order to help to supplement the Egyptian economy? We'll find out soon. All right, that's it for today. Read our expert analysis on our website, FDD.org. Read our quick takes on X at FDD and support our work with a tax-deductible donation at FDD.org/invest. Tune in Wednesday for another installment of the FDD Morning Brief. Same time, same place. Until then, I'm Jonathan Shanzer, signing off for FDD.